Te reo ererangi o te mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak up. Kōrerotia. Tune in as our guests speak up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right. Ko speak up, kōrerotia tēnei, ko Sally Carlton aho. Today we are thinking about anti-nuclear advocacy in 2025. It's a period at the moment where this is top of mind for many people. It's very present in news and in international discussion. We've just had the 80th anniversary of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the 40th anniversary of the bombing of the Rainbow Warrior here in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Not to mention all the different conflicts that are taking place around the world and the increasing arms race between nuclear nations as well. So there's a lot going on, and it seems a very opportune moment to be thinking about these sorts of issues. I'm super excited about our panel of guests today. We've got four guests, two of whom have been on the show before, David Roby and Kate Hughes, and two of whom are new to our show, Hallie Birch and Susan Vutere. So I'd like to invite you all now to share a wee bit about yourselves, ko wai koe, talking about maybe your background or your work, whatever you feel like introducing, and how you've got to this place now on the show. I'm going to pick on Kali.
Kia ora koutou. It's really lovely to be here with everyone, and where to start? I guess I'll start by saying it's interesting to go first because I'm someone who entered this conversation through the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear energy disaster, which is owned by Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO. So I've had this really long journey to this space. I actually grew up in Hawaii, so I'm a settler from Hawaii. So I've lived in the Pacific all my life. I was actually doing my master's degree in agroecology in 2011 when the Fukushima Daiichi disaster erupted. So there was the earthquake, the tsunami, and then the triple meltdown there. And so I spent my master's degree studying that. I then transitioned from agroecology to sociology because I really needed social theory to understand what was going on. I spent my PhD looking into the issue. And then after my PhD, I just had so many questions, specifically historically. In my PhD, I really was tracing the history of the dominant nuclear science that was activated in the aftermath of the nuclear energy disaster. Then I would trace back to the U.S. dropping of atomic weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So I was noticing that there was a historical link between nuclear weapons and nuclear energy, but I really wanted to dive in deeper. And so that's what I've been doing since my PhD, really. I've been doing a mapping project with a colleague, Emily Simmons, where we're mapping the nuclear complex from 1945 until today, putting nuclear energy reactors, bomb detonations, uranium mines, ocean dumping of nuclear waste, uranium processing and reprocessing all on maps together, as well as international treaties that have been trying to, you know, stop the expansion of the nuclear complex. So we've been doing that mapping project. It's almost finished. But yeah, that's the space I'm in today, is really thinking about those connections between nuclear energy and nuclear weapons and this long history, and using a lot of social theory to help me think through that as well.
Wow, that sounds amazing. It's going to be a complex map, I suspect.
Oh, yes. It's a mess.
And Susan, how about the other newbie?
Morena, kia koutou katoa. I'm a fourth generation New Zealander with very mixed background, actually, from Åland Islands, which is now part of Finland, but was originally part of Sweden, some Syrian and Lebanese background, Scotland, England, but also, of course, Kiwi. So very much part of the land here. I teach at the University of Canterbury, Japanese literature and arts and culture. And I suppose my journey, how did I get here? My journey, I think, with Japan, and also which led to studying and thinking about and connections to survivors of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, began with my time as a student at the University of Canterbury studying Japanese and then Japanese literature, and then traveling studying in Japan, doing several postgraduate degrees there. So I think the language firstly brought me to Japan and also connected me with Hibakusho survivors of the bombing of Hiroshima, beginning with Bun Hashizume, whose memoirs I translated. And so that began with organizing interviews and talks and media interviews and interpreting for example, Bun, but other visitors from Hiroshima and Nagasaki who were survivors of the bombings. So I've done a lot of having to work and meet with these people. It really left a very big impact on me and led to me translating some of these works, which has been incredibly challenging, actually, but also very moving and enormous learning experience. Yeah, which of course led to more research and thinking about these issues and eventually teaching about these issues.
Thank you, Susan. I think we're already getting a sense of you're coming from different perspectives, but I think we'll see some synergies. And David, how about we hear from you?
Well, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Thanks very much for inviting me. I was a journalist working in Paris for the French news agency, Agence France-Presse, in the early 70s. And I discovered an issue that I hadn't really thought about or even was aware of before I left Aotearoa, which is the French nuclear testing. This was associated with the colonial policies in the region. And I started writing in my spare time, writing articles for New Zealand media about French policies, particularly after nuclear testing had begun in 1966 in the Pacific. And over time, well, I specialised a lot in environmental journalism back then. When I left AFP and returned to Aotearoa, I was the foreign news editor on Auckland Star for a couple of years. And I sort of developed interest in nuclear policies and also environmental issues and decided, well, it's much easier if I actually go freelance. So I became rather a specialist in the area. And then in 1985, I was on board the Rainbow Warrior on the voyage to the Marshall Islands, where we helped the radiated people from Rongelap, one of the atolls in the Marshall Islands, move to another island, relocated there. And that was quite an extraordinary humanitarian experience that I had. So that sort of kept me on this trajectory. And about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, my wife is actually a member of WILF, and she's been quite active on these issues. And in 2018, we were actually in Nagasaki for the events at the time there. Unfortunately, I didn't get to Hiroshima. But since then, when I left the Auckland Star, eventually after a freelance period, I was appointed to the University of Papua New Guinea. I ran the journalism program there for 5 years, and then also the University of South Pacific journalism program. And throughout this time, I was really developing expertise in environmental issues, and particularly in nuclear issues in the Pacific, and encouraging my students to develop their own expertise in these areas. And then when I came back to Aotearoa, I was with the Auckland University of Technology, and I founded the Pacific Media Centre, which ran for 13 years. So we specialised very much on environmental issues in the Pacific, and we had a lot of postgraduate programmes associated around the centre itself. Unfortunately, I retired in 2020, and as what often happens in academic institutions, they ditched the centre, so very disappointing. Anyway, since retiring, I mean, I only retired from the university life, and I still am very active as a journalist and in the community. I published two websites, Asia Pacific Report, which is largely current affairs and so on, but that specializes quite a lot in environmental and decolonization issues in the Pacific. And then I've got my own one, Cafe Pacific, which is more long-form journalism and research and various books. I've just had a book published, The Eyes of Fire, which is the sixth edition of this, actually. It's quite extraordinary. The book has had a life of its own. But this latest one, the foreword, was written by our former New Zealand Prime Minister, Helen Clark. And there's a real synergy there between her views and what we've been advocating in the book. So that's been more or less the trajectory that I've been following. Thanks.
Amazing career, David. And Kate, our final guest.
Thank you, Sally. Kia ora, everyone. Lovely to be on the show again. I suppose mine started in Auckland with the Peace Squadron. My first husband was the secretary of the Peace Squadron in Auckland, and I made the tea for the skippers for the first action that went out because the meeting was in our house when we stopped to the Long Beach coming into Auckland Harbour. So we're looking 1975, around that time, 76, but also very much involved right from the beginning with the Peace Foundation in Auckland before studying peace studies at Bradford University in England and realising they knew nothing about what was happening in our region and started to try and share what was happening about nuclear testing in our region, and then came back and had three babies quite quickly, one after another, and still ran the office of the Peace Foundation from home, but began to teach peace studies at Canterbury University and was very involved in the local little active groups, but also setting up Peace Movement Aotearoa in 1980, around that time. But also I got involved with a project from one of our little groups here to take a case to the International Court of Justice to get the question of the legality of nuclear weapons tested at the court. And that took 10 years of my life, from 86 to 96, juggling teaching part-time at the university in peace studies for 20 years and bringing up three kids on my own. During that time, I started writing my PhD up on how we took this case to the World Court. And that's been quite significant. Next year will be the 30th anniversary of the opinion from the court. I was very involved in getting Christchurch nuclear free as the first nuclear free city in 1982 in our little groups here. And also in WILP, we published a book called Pacific Women Speak Out for Independence and Denuclearization. So making the links again with colonization and what was happening in our region. As Susan mentioned, she would often come to our place if there were Hibakusha visiting and translate, including Bun Hashizumi, who often used to stay here. I worked closely with Elsie Locke and a lot of the peace people in Canterbury, local Māori. And my trajectory was very interesting because I got appointed to the UN study on disarmament education for the Secretary General, and that was a 2-year appointment. And then the next thing, I was asked to be on the UN Secretary General's Advisory Board on Disarmament as one of the few women, but also one of the few NGOs. And that became very interesting for me to be able to have input at that level from an ordinary New Zealand position, and was involved in the Public Advisory Committee on Disarmament, which was set up under the Nuclear Free Act. And so had a role in that of advising government on the implementation of our nuclear free law. And of course, it's 40 years since that law was passed in 2 years' time. So life has been very interesting. We've continued to do the work in Canterbury. We had the first peace city announced on the 20th anniversary of the nuclear free city. We've just had the World Peace Bell here given to Canterbury, which has been great. And we're working on a range of issues with our young people in particular to get a museum exhibition to mark some of these anniversaries that are coming up. So life is interesting. My second marriage was to a former British commander who flew nukes around. So we're an interesting partnership and we're now working a lot with young people. But thanks, Sally, for the opportunity to share.
Thank you, guys. And I think just taking a second to appreciate the absolute wealth of experience you are all bringing to this panel. It's really rich and I'm really excited to hear what we've got to say. So I guess as we kick off the kōrero today then, I was thinking maybe we think about the different anniversaries and what they might mean and then sort of bring it up to the present context. So if we think back 80 years to the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the fact that we've just had the 80th anniversary, what did you do personally? What was happening around the world? And what does it mean when we sit there and reflect back on these sorts of events?
On Sunday, we hosted about 200 people in pouring rain round our World Peace Bell. Susan read from Bun Hashizumi's book, which was wonderful. And the mayor came and planted a new seedling from a tree from Hiroshima. So we've got one from Nagasaki that survived, a seedling from there, and one from Hiroshima now. And lots of city councillors, lots of all age groups, right through from 93 down to the babies that were there. So it's wonderful to think that that will continue. We've been doing it since 1976. Every single year, we're putting lanterns on the river, until I think there was only 1 year it was flooded, and then that was all closed during the earthquake. So we then moved to the World Peace Bell. But it's just wonderful. I'm putting flowers on the river instead of lanterns now in the Botanic Gardens. So very important to mark it.
It's a really important time, actually, when we think of the global situation. But what did I do myself? As Kate said, I went along to a commemoration here in Christchurch, which is held every year, and it's always a very moving event. And I read from Boone's book, which I translated the day the sun fell, and also a couple of her poems, because I think that art is very powerful, that it engages us in ways that normal commentary can't, because we, in a sense, are semi-placed in that position. We identify with the voice, and therefore we go to a certain extent through their experiences in a pseudo-sense. So it's very powerful, very moving, I think. But what did I do in terms of my work with my cultural class? We looked at the movie Black Rain, which is based on the novel Black Rain. The novel was published in 1966, but the movie came out in 1989. They're both good works to look at because they have flashbacks which go back to the actual day of the bombing of Hiroshima and, you know, all the scenes that people witness, and it's very much based on witnesses' testimonies, actually, the original work, to the point that the writer Ibuse Masuji did come under some criticism for so-called plagiarism. So it's set in the 1950s, is looking at the ongoing impact of this event. And so I also bring in the fact that, you know, survivors continue to experience effects of the bombing. And so actually this event is not something of the past, but it's something that is still living for these survivors. And recently you talked about the 2023 verdict around the effects of black rain, which fell in Hiroshima after the bombing, and this big court case that finally reached a conclusion that these people outside this very small designated area, but who had been caught up in the black rain, were actually also hibakusha. So this issue of secondary radiation poisoning is also part of this work. And also the other thing that I normally talk about is, why is it that the director chose to actually bring this topic to the theatres some 40 or so years after the event? So we look at, there were many things going on in the 80s, the Chernobyl disaster in 1986, discussions between the Soviet Union and the USA around nuclear weapons and reduction of nuclear weapons. There's also 1985 was a big appeal sent out globally from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So there's all those global events. And then I always bring it back to the Pacific, the South Pacific, and try as much as possible to relate these things, to bring them closer to home. And of course, there's a lot to talk about with regards to South Pacific and the 80s and all of these nuclear tests, growing resistant, and how that comes to a head in the 1980s. And of course, events such as the bombing of the Rainbow Warrior in Auckland Port and the eventual adaptation of a nuclear free zone in New Zealand. So I always look at that background and try and make these events more relatable, you know, how they impact on the world as a whole and little New Zealand too. Another thing that I did with the advanced language students, so I always get them to actually read a little bit in the original Japanese from Bun Hashizume's memoirs. This year I also looked at, there was a wonderful editorial in a newspaper, Asahi Shimbun, about this husband and wife team of artists and these huge panels that they created. I'm not sure if you've heard of them, Iri and Toshi Maruki, a couple who were both artists. He was from Hiroshima. He wasn't there at the time, but went back to help family and help out, rescue people about 3 days after the bombing. And then she followed. And so then they painted these huge panels, 15 of them in all, of the scenes that they witnessed and the aftermath, and based on what they witnessed themselves, but also what they heard from others, survivors from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. there's a wonderful editorial in Japanese. So I got them to read that. And then there's also a very good video that in Japanese introduces, shows us, takes us through the gallery, the Maruki Gallery, where we can actually see these huge big panels and talks about them and talks about the work that these two artists did. So that's what I did on my mahi, my teaching side.
Amazing. Thank you, Susan. I think you've really set out how those events have not only temporal relevance, but also physical relevance to different parts around the world, I think, as well.
I might share what we were doing. We had the good fortune of being invited, my wife, Del, and myself, to Puniki, to Wellington, for the Aro Valley Peace Talks, which was on the Saturday. And it was a joint invitation by both Tim Bollinger and his team, organized the Peace Talks, but also the Fabian Society, Just Defense, an NGO that's really taking quite an active role here. So jointly, they invited us both. And I spoke at the Fabian Society on the Friday evening, and then we took part in the Peace Talks. And it was really quite an eclectic day, but it was lots of really interesting people. Mari Leadbeater was there, Mark Darby talking about Owen Wilkes and the book that was produced. Many of us, including myself, contributed chapters dedicated to Owen Wilkes's extraordinary efforts as a peace campaigner over the years. You know, they had a really good feeling, even in spite of the terrible weather. A lot of music and a lot of good vibes generally. But also there was an exhibition in part of the community center devoted to Hiroshima and Nagasaki and also the nuclear-free efforts of communities right across Aotearoa over the years. And that was quite impressive. And I thought that was really interesting too, because I'm one of the founders of an NGO called the Asia-Pacific Media Network, which we set up about 4 years ago now. And we also organized a exhibition just recently around the time of the Rainbow Warrior bombing anniversary for a nuclear-free Pacific campaign. So our focus, although we had quite a lot on Aotearoa as well, our main focus was on the nuclear-free movements around the Pacific, Tahiti, Vanuatu, and so on. And I was thinking, oh, it would have been really great if actually we'd just been able to combine our resources, you know. So our one in Tamaki Makaurau was at the Ellen Melville Centre, and we had it on for a week there, and that was really good. And in fact, we just put that on now, just a couple of days ago this week. We went across to Waiheke Island, and it's been set up now in the Waiheke Public Library, and it will be on display now until mid-September. Really good efforts all around.
I'm working on a book. I'm basically writing about the history of nuclear science and like how we even understand what radionuclides are, what radiation is. So I've been writing about that, and I wrote about, you know, how uranium transformed into this thing that was used to, you know, color glass and things like that, to being this element that could be used to create a fusion reaction. And so I was going from, you know, what was happening in Los Alamos at the Trinity site and these long histories. I've been writing about that. And so this anniversary was actually interesting because I follow so many people, especially on social media. I highly recommend the Nuclear Truth Project. They've been doing some really great work. So I've been writing about these histories. And then I see that, you know, Nuclear Truth Project is going to the Trinity site, and I get to see the communities there that I've been writing a little bit about their story. So it's been really meaningful in that way. I social media has so many problems, but it's a really great way to kind of stay connected, especially when there are great activist group and scholars out there connecting the dots between things. And I will say one of the things that was really moving, a colleague, Fiona Amundsen at AUT, she's been doing some really great work. She's an artist and a photographer, but she went to Hiroshima and she took photos of the trees that survived the atomic bomb blast. And I'm forgetting their name. There is a name for these trees. They are like ancestors. What she does is she'll take photos of them and then she develops them with film. I'm not sure how she developed that film, but in a lot of other projects she's been doing, she'll take seaweed from the ocean so that there are radionuclides in the solution that she's using to develop these photographs. And so you get to see pieces of lab. I found that to be a moving project.
And I also add that one of the things that we did during Peace Week was to show Kathleen Gallagher's film, Totemote, Breath of Peace, to a full theatre in Christchurch, one in Wellington and one in Auckland, and it's going to be shown at the International Peace Research Association conference in New Plymouth later this year. And that's a film with eight of us peace activists speaking, George Armstrong and Bunny McDiarmid and Mary Woodward and Moana Cole, Nikki Hagar. It's 20 years since we made the film down here, and it's great to see it still being used. We're also putting the same Hiroshima Nagasaki exhibition of 30 paintings and that's come from Hiroshima up at the university for a couple of weeks in the library. So that's going to travel around over the whole year around the region, and it's a great opportunity for education.
You've all actually mentioned creative responses and exhibitions and the role that that element plays in remembrance. And how about if we fast forward another 40 years to the bombing of the Rainbow Warrior, and the anniversary was only a week or two beforehand. Was there any particular or separate events commemorating the Rainbow Warrior?
I might kick off on that because, in fact, I was on Rainbow Warrior 3 for that event and quite a few things that were happening that day. So Rainbow Warrior 3 came to Tamaki Makaurau to mark the event, but it was quite extraordinary. I was there the night before and they had a team that were filming this current Rainbow Warrior, and members of the crew had actually sort of lined themselves around the deck and each one held up a fluorescent letter and carried the message, "You can't sink a rainbow." But it was actually incredibly spectacular. And I was there just on dusk and just took some photographs myself. Greenpeace were doing it for a video to sort of mark the occasion. On the day itself, at 7 o'clock, we had this dawn ceremony and the Ngāti Whātua started the whole ceremony. And we had a number of speakers reflecting on what had happened. For me, myself, I was roped in by some of the Greenpeace communications team to do a sort of virtual tour of the Rainbow Warrior. They sort of set that up so people all around the world could actually see what this amazing campaign ship is, because it's quite extraordinary to compare Rainbow Warrior 3 with the original one that I was on for the Rongelap operation. I was asked to sort of reflect on what had happened 40 years ago. Later on in the evening, we had the launch of the latest edition of my book, Eyes of Fire. We had a show of many of the photographs in the background. I mean, Fernando Pereira, who lost his life tragically on that bombing, a lot of his photographs are well known, you know, on Greenpeace's the website, and you know, over the years have been shown quite a lot. But I also took photographs, and largely slides and also black and white photographs, and most of those photographs have been shown in exhibitions from that time. But I always remember Fernando, because back in those days, communications was really very difficult to tell the story. Fernando set up a dark room in the ship's library, and he had to process his films, because to communicate, this was in the days of using wire machine, which was just like a cylinder, and you basically process the photo, print the photo, and then wrap the photo around a cylinder. And then that was transmitted to San Francisco, where Greenpeace had a communications center. Very, very slow process. So both Fernando and I had to spend quite a bit of time in the radio operator, Lloyd Anderson, in his setup, which was just off the bridge on the Rainbow Warrior. So I was reflecting on some of the issues, because these days, you know, communications are so incredible. And back then, it was just a mission every day, getting some photographs out to the world. That's why I never tried to process any of mine until I actually got back to Aotearoa. So that was quite a cool day, but really quite inspiring. But I should also mention that just over a week later, Helen Clark, at the time of the anniversary itself, she was overseas. But when she came back, we had an event also on the Rainbow Warrior just before it left. And she reflected on 40 years ago and David Longhi's government, the nuclear-free sort of campaigns. Very heady, very inspiring time.
That's really interesting and actually really inspiring to hear about all the things that are doing there. I feel that in many ways we perhaps need to do a little bit more around those events and getting that out. I feel that, you know, when I've talked about it with students, that they don't really know much about it. And I suppose because there's no nuclear testing going on in this region now, it feels a little bit distant, I think, and there's therefore a lot of it's been forgotten. So I think anything that we can do to remember, commemorate some of these events and remember what happened in the 80s and what happened in the South Pacific and with the resistance by Palau and Vanuatu and Fiji and then New Zealand as part of this whole Rainbow Warrior bombing, I think it would be good if we could. Yeah, I think we need a little bit more going on to commemorate those events and keep them alive in a sense, particularly given the current situation in the world.
Can I say I was very encouraged by the webinar that Helen Clark Foundation organised as well. Helen has about 600 people watching her webinar. It's quite scary being a participant. The following day, I think it was, David, after she'd done that other interview, she did this webinar with four or five of us with Russell Norman as well, and asked some very, very good questions and looked at the effects of our nuclear-free policy and also the emasculation of the UN at the moment. And of course, it's the 80th anniversary since it was established. Who better to ask those questions and to be looking at what we're doing in the future in this particular country, having been a leader on nuclear disarmament and other issues, where's our voice now? You know, and she certainly is continuing to speak out. So I just wanted to honour that. But also I think you'd asked a question earlier about what activities had we done in the past on Rainbow Warrior. And I can remember 5 years on in the square, we would be holding commemoration events, but it's waned a lot. But having quite a few kids and having taught at schools, I was quite interested in how much about the Rainbow Warrior is actually in the school syllabus, whereas our nuclear-free policy isn't. So it is encouraging that there's quite a lot on the web that's available, films and a lot of your work, David, for teachers to be able to use. But I agree, we've got to keep remembering and witnessing. And as Bunny says in the film, when she talks about it in Tota Modi, she just said, the reaction to us was so horrific, we knew we were doing the right thing. We encourage our young people, keep out there speaking because you are on the right track. New Zealand mustn't lose that voice.
Something that Susan said about the fact that it's not a lot that's known. I just want to say something about a project we did 10 years ago in 2015 when I was at AUT University. We had 40 students involved in a project around the Rainbow Warriors anniversary at that time, where we basically had two cohorts of students. One cohort was would-be journalists, and the other one were television people. So what we did was we gave them an assignment. For the journalism ones, they had to research and do a short news report of 2.5 minutes on various aspects around the Rainbow Warrior and the nuclear-free policy and the environment, climate crisis as well. I was astounded at the time because these are students around about 20, 21, 22 and so on. I assumed that most would have a pretty good idea. And I was quite astounded to find that hardly anybody knew very much at all. And they actually got quite excited about the whole project. And what we tried to do was sort of oral histories of many of the people involved, because, you know, in the last 10 years, two of the Rainbow Warrior crew, for example, have passed on, sadly. And so we wanted to get those stories captured. And the publisher of my book, they did the previous edition as well, they wanted to create this website. So we've got this website, Eyes of Fire, 30 years on, and we're just in the process of updating that now, where all those students' stories and the television ones, what they had to do was a researched studio interview for 20 minutes or so, where they organized and did the research and then carried out the interviews. And it's all tremendously good stuff, and it's really good for education. I would love to see that site actually become more widely known. Greenpeace has got excellent resources as well. Many of the media organisations did things, but it's mostly about proclaiming what they did and that sort of thing. And I think that this one is actually much more focused on resources for education. Thanks.
So there's a great revival of the movement, Nuclear Free and Independent Pacific Movement, but specifically there have been, Te Hui O Ranga o Te Moana Nui a Kiwa, which is a hui for those concerned about the well-being of the Pacific. These conferences started in 1982, and there was a revival of them specifically here in Tamaki Makaurau in 2024. Te Kuaka, which is led by Marco de Jong and Adam Arata. They gathered people from across the Pacific, Manuhiri guests who came here, and it was just very moving. And so it's interesting. I think in the past, a lot of the discussions were probably focused a lot on nuclear issues, but now we can see how those issues have expanded. It's deep sea mining, it's general U.S. imperialism in the Pacific. Nuclear is a part of this wider story as well. But I highly recommend, like, this is another 40-year anniversary that we've recently had. That's important because it was the nuclear free and independent Pacific movement that produced the momentum that eventually led to the nuclear free policy that we have here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, even though the history is often told in a different way.
Mm.
It's interesting to reflect on what is being remembered or pulled into, particularly education, and what perhaps not so much. Kate, you mentioned the Rainbow Warrior being part of the curriculum, but perhaps less so the legislation that's come afterwards, which is connected.
Yeah, and I want to acknowledge NFIP movement as well. Carly, certainly I was involved in those early days of NFIP. And acknowledge especially the role of women in the Pacific. It's why we did that book, got the stories published when we could. It's actually been published in Japanese as well, which is great. It took so many of us doing so much at the grassroots level all over the country. It can never be just one group given credit for anything really, but the nuclear free zone thing, the peace squadrons, this campaign for nuclear disarmament, all of them, and building on what had been led before, way back in the early 60s with the petition for no bombs south of the line to get a southern hemisphere nuclear-free zone. And that was the second biggest petition in this country after the vote for women. So again, it's really important our young people know all that heritage that goes back and also all the pacifism and also the iwi that were non-violent, Waitaha and others. There's heritage there that peacemakers and Māori history as well, which is often not acknowledged.
We've already started discussing it, but how about thinking about these anniversaries in the current context of what's going on in the world?
Yeah, well, it's horrific how much
yes.
on nuclear weapons just this last year, $100 billion US dollars in the last year, up 11%, and $57 billion, so half of that. Oh, more than half was by the United States. The UK has just increased its spending by 26%. I read something on the International Campaign Against Nuclear Weapons site the other day that 1 year of money spent on nuclear weapons could fund the entire UN budget 28 times over.
Mm.
But let's acknowledge that, you know, we have succeeded in many ways. We have got a treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. I was there when it went through at the UN in 2017. And we've now got 94 countries who've joined it and 73 have ratified. That is very good news. The numbers are down from when my kids were all born and we thought that the world would be blown up 24 times over, and it could have been. It was horrific. We've got rid of a huge number of weapons, but as we know, we've got countries that are threatening to use them, not least Russia and Israel. And often Israel is not even acknowledged as a country that has as many nuclear weapons as Britain. And let alone the threats between India and Pakistan and other countries. So we still have to keep our eye on the ball, and we still have to keep working for international law to uphold these treaties that we do have. But we've also got to encourage countries to speak out. And our country has lost its voice on this, sadly, at the moment.
I agree. I think that actually these commemorations are hugely important, and in particular at this time, given the situation and nuclear facilities in Iran being deliberately targeted. Of course, in Ukraine, we know that their nuclear facilities got caught up in the conflict. The discussion of perhaps using nuclear weapons, the US moving in nuclear submarines. I mean, it's a very worrying times in the context of this growing tension and little being done in terms of actually de-escalating a conflict. So I think the commemorations are hugely important in that they do put the spotlight back on nuclear weapons and, you know, those catastrophic events of the past and their continuing effects, and therefore send a kind of a warning or reminder of that enormous destructive power of nuclear arms. And what we do know, of course, is that the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were far, far smaller than the nuclear weapons that they have now. So the implications of even an accident with nuclear weapons or nuclear facilities is larger than they were in the past. Again, so I think from that point of view, just that focus, bringing back that focus each year is really important. Of course, we saw a very strong message go out to the world from the Hiroshima prefectural governor. He was quite frank about the current situation and really denounced the very aggressive approach to conflict and relations around the world, and sent out a very strong warning around nuclear arms and how they need to be eliminated. Coming from, I think, Hiroshima and, of course, Nagasaki, these messages have quite a lot of weight behind them. So from that point of view, again, it grabs people's attention. If we didn't have those commemorations, then, you know, these things could just fly under the radar again. So I think that they're hugely important, and particularly in the current global situation.
I forgot to mention that the mapping project I'm doing, the seed funding for it came from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. And I was really excited about that because we did mention wanting to talk about nuclear weapons and nuclear energy together. And honestly, that is not something that is welcomed a lot of times in discussions about nuclear weapons. Again, in my book, I'm going to dig into this a little more. But, you know, the Atoms for Peace propaganda campaign, if not the biggest, it was one of the biggest propaganda campaigns driven by the U.S. The U.S. had a domestic propaganda campaign to really, you know, mobilize a good type of nuclear fear that was useful for their project of capitalist empire expansion. But there was then this international campaign, and it still sticks with us today. And maybe some people listening are like, wait, what? Like, you're not supposed to talk about nuclear energy and nuclear weapons together, and here I am. And it might sound controversial, but there is, if you trace the history, there is a link between the two. And there are people like Robert Jacobs, a historian who's written a great piece called Born Violent, where he's able to link, you know, technically the prototypes for the first nuclear energy reactors were actually reactors that were creating plutonium for nuclear weapons. So there's this long history. And I guess the important thing to think about is, you know, why are we so stuck? And one of the things that we're writing about in the paper regarding the maps is how that Atoms for Peace, the way that we think about that, it's still encoded. Even in the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, they have to promote the peaceful use of nuclear energy. Now, I'm not saying any technology is good or bad, but when a technology is linked to imperial power, it's going to be warped in certain ways in the way we understand it, and the way we're able to acknowledge the waste and the wasting that it brings. And so I think for me, that's something that we really need to be thinking about, is those long histories, thinking about why we're still stuck today. Because the infrastructures that are used to create nuclear energy reactors are the same ones that are used to create nuclear weapons. And so the energy now is being rebranded as sustainable. Again, we can see it as the next move. It was peaceful. It was progressive. There was Chernobyl. There was Three Mile Island. Oops. It's rebranded as sustainable now. And that's where we are today. And it's a very powerful move. You know, even after Fukushima Daiichi, it's still going strong. And so we need to be thinking about that today.
One of the observations I had from last Saturday at our Talks of Peace in Aro Valley was that there seemed to be a real need for a new momentum, something comparable that we had in the 80s, a real revitalization, if you like. My impression was that most of our people that we actually had at that seminar workshop was really good, really inspiring. But most of us are getting on. And there were very few young people actually there. We shared lots of very successful stories that have happened and campaigns that have happened over the past. But there was not a lot of focus on what do we do now, you know, in the next phase, if you like. the crises in the world at the moment, one of the things I like to mention about Iran, the attack, I thought, was an absolutely crazy attack on Iran. I've been in Iran for a number of weeks, and I've written about Iran quite a lot. I personally don't believe that Iran had any intention of actually having a nuclear weapon. But now, because of what has happened, because of that war, it would be quite understandable in a way that Iran will probably think that in a matter of self-defense, they've actually got to develop something like that. So this is a crazy world we're in at the moment, you know, when the Trumpian sort of influence all over the world with the massive spending of military arms and so on that Kate was mentioning earlier on. And one of the things I sort of really asked myself, what is wrong? Why are we using the tools at our disposal, the tools at the United Nations disposal, uniting for peace? One or two journalist colleagues of ours, we've been trying to write something about this and so on, but especially no discussion about that. Uniting for peace is actually quite an extraordinary tool the United Nations has, and it's available. The war on Gaza, like 22 months, it's our greatest moral crisis at this time. And the failure of the world not putting a stop to this seems really horrendous. But uniting for peace seems a relatively straightforward approach. It was first used when the General Assembly Resolution 377 that was developed in 1950 for the Korean War. And it's been used actually 13 times since. But yet there's no real discussion or debate about that as an option now, 22 months on, and that war, you know, with to think of the risks of nuclear risks in the background as well. The continuous vetoes that we've had in the Security Council, why isn't there some discussion? Is it failure within the Secretary General's office in the United Nations, or where is it? Why is there no real discussion about this among political leaders to make a move after 22 months? Why can't we have the Uniting for Peace? Because, as I understand it, it actually can be called within 24 hours, and the United Nations can actually decide to send in peacekeepers, particularly to protect people and to protect humanitarian supply of food and so on. So I'd be interested to know if any of you others, have you actually thought about that, uniting for peace? Can somebody answer that for me?
Nuclear weapons. I always teach my students, I show the picture of U.S. representative, a black woman from the U.S. raising her hand to veto. Why do they have that power? It is nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you raised that, David. I mean, the UN at the moment is absolutely emasculated. Like, who are the criminals at the moment? I can say Netanyahu and the ICC, International Criminal Court, and the case before the International Court of Justice on genocide issue. Where the hell is that going? Why hasn't he been arrested? And why haven't a few others been arrested and taken before the courts? We know who thinks he rules the whole world at the moment. I listened to the 7 o'clock news this morning and I heard something about Trump saying there might be a nuclear arms deal with his talks with Putin. But there is no recall back to the UN at the moment, even though there's a reasonably strong UN Secretary General. But I've seen the UN system so stymied at times. New Zealand in the past used to write a lot of papers on reform of the UN, getting rid of the veto. We never supported it right at the beginning, 80 years ago. I don't know, David. It's incredibly hard to look at where peacemakers could get into Israel. They can't even get food in.
Yeah.
And to be allowed to get away with it. The other one I wanted to say is allowed to get away with it is countries like Japan and others who have a massive buildup of plutonium and could make nuclear weapons very quickly. But how come it's okay to bomb Iraq, supposedly with no nuclear weapons, doing the right thing under IAEA, but to let Japan and others? We know it's to do with the Western hegemony and the systems that are
sheer hypocrisy.
Absolutely. And we're joining in with that by observing or being a partner in NATO, and our voice being emasculated, getting back into ANZUS, and we are effectively back in ANZUS. Japanese frigates we're now buying, by the look of it, with Australia. You know, our voice is not independent anymore. And this is what worries me. This is what we're wanting to train our young students to be speaking out about, the need for us to be independent. And this government, by the way, has also just canned the disarmament Education UN Implementation Fund, which was set up after I was on that UN study. It was only $200,000 a year. In fact, it was only $150,000 to start with 20 years ago. And now this government has cut that money, and it means that five groups around the country that have been absolutely dependent on continuing to do this educational work are being cut. So we can't have our websites. You know, there's no funding for this work. And what's it going to buy? What's $100,000 going to buy? Anything towards any missile or helicopter? What the heck? This is the direction we're heading. And this is what we need to be speaking out and getting a backbone, thank you, Chloe, for lots of our political parties to actually get some decent foreign policy objectives and not supporting the nuclear industry and the military industrial complex by buying into the machinery. So thank God Helen is still speaking out, but we need to also be training up our young members of parliament and our older ones to speak out on these issues. Sorry, I feel quite strongly about this, as you can tell.
I think we all do. I mean, you know, I think the silence of our government on these issues, on the targeting of Iran's nuclear facilities and on Gaza, and clearly we have a genocide, you know, in process. It's very disillusioning, I think, when we have been so outspoken in the past and when we have been prepared as a nation to stick our necks out and take also the flak and the fallout from sticking our necks out. If you think of what, you know, happened with the nuclear-free policy and you know, not allowing US submarines and ships, et cetera, to come into port, and the effect of that on our trading relationship with the US, et cetera, and diplomatic relations there. So we were prepared to sort of take a hit from that. And I think in a sense, I don't know how everyone else feels, but certainly for me as a New Zealander, that's kind of been something that I felt very proud of, actually. It feels quite humiliating, but more than that, actually shocking and disillusioning to see the silence of our own government, and of course, even more so with the inability of the UN to take any action. And if I'm radical, I would say we need to see the dismantling of the current UN and its reconstitution without, you know, the Security Council where they have this veto. Just coming back to a moment to the nuclear deterrence issue, the fallacy of that, the Hiroshima prefecture governor spoke very strongly out against that, that it's not a deterrent, that there are other effective means of deterring war and solving conflict, including soft power and, of course, good old diplomacy. So that, but also I wanted to talk just very briefly about the nuclear power plants. Of course, Bun, in her memoir, which I translated, you know, she had earlier published her memoirs, and then she added about 10 chapters the time that I was translating it. And one of them was from Fukushima and writing about Fukushima and nuclear power plant meltdowns there. Of course, we saw it was Chernobyl, but then it appeared to be contained. But what we see with Fukushima nuclear power plants is that our inability, in a sense, for us to contain, to clean up after some of these major incidents at nuclear power plants, and therefore the real dangers of having nuclear power. And of course, although it doesn't appear in the news much, because of this idea, as you say, the kind of promotion of nuclear power plants as being somehow clean and safe and a peaceful use of nuclear energy, that a lot of the ongoing issues with the Fukushima nuclear power plants are hidden. But what we do know is, of course, that, you know, they're still releasing radioactive waste into the sea from the Fukushima nuclear power plants because they don't have enough containers, are unable to deal with it there. And how that affects not only the local environment and the fishermen and that industry, but also how that affects these globally, actually. So that pollution. So the idea that nuclear power plants are somehow safe and clean is just a fallacy as well. And Bun says quite strongly in her book, actually, I just read that. The only way to avert a nuclear disaster is to eliminate all nuclear weapons and nuclear energy from around the globe.
One of the things that I'm really concerned about is the silence of the media. It's very noticeable that in the 80th anniversaries and also the 40th anniversary of Rainbow Warrior, there's virtually hardly anything in the news media. No reflections, very little discussion about what have we learned, what is the future holding out for us, and what do we need to do, sort of thing. The silence of the media is really quite disturbing. Now, I've been involved in Palestinian protests for the last 97 weeks, and I've spoken at some of these rallies about the media and the silence of the media, and I wonder where are the other journalists actually speaking out about this. You know, we're seeing a pushback all over the world, but hardly anything here. Now, some of the protests have actually gone to TVNZ and protested there. And yet TVNZ doesn't even acknowledge that these protests take place. And they're quite big protests. And all over the world, we have media coverage. And yet in New Zealand, it's sort of like this silence generally about even about our policies. The fact that we're being sort of sucked into AUKUS and so on. And that is very little discussion about this. So that's one of the things that I just wanted to sort of share, challenging that silence.
I agree. I find it really disturbing, and I wonder what is behind this silence, because the silence is so loud in a sense. Why are we being so silent? Why is it that someone is calling on people to stand up in Parliament and are rejected? That silence, right in the very heart of our government, I find incredibly disturbing, and I wonder, you know, where exactly does that come from? What's going on behind the scenes?
I can put my sociologist hat on, and I just thinking about the very long history of when we say Western hegemony, we are talking about like a capitalist empire that is basically a military alliance across, you know, members of the global north. And that's where we are today. So thinking about how capitalism relies intrinsically on imperialism. And so when we think about the Red Scare and things like that, when things are really important to the project of capitalism sustaining itself, which it requires imperialism, it requires new frontiers. When that gets threatened, the project of imperialism gets threatened, that's when there's a lot of work that goes into, you know, dividing and conquering. So you're a communist and you're bad, or now you're anti-Semite if you say anything critical about what is happening in Gaza. And so for me, when I'm watching it, it's like, okay, when I see those kinds of ideological moves that get really powerful really quickly, it means it's really important to these projects of imperialism. But I will say, I think the climate crisis is something that we've kind of touched on a bit, but there are really great scholars, especially in the world ecology conversation, that are talking about capitalism, like a really long history of capitalism dating back to Columbus, and how when you think of capitalism, not as like this abstract thing, but as like situated processes that are transforming the world ecology. So because capitalism relies on imperialism, it's always spreading around the globe. And so what scholars in this space are saying is like the current planetary crisis is actually capitalogenic. It's derived from capitalism and the specific ways that capitalist modes of relating are transforming societies and environments. And so the thing that they're saying is that capitalism itself is in crisis, because there are no more frontiers. We can see they're going to American Samoa to drill the ocean. It's like they're trying to find resources in places that we haven't gone yet. But basically, capitalism is in crisis. And so we're going to be seeing some transition to post-capitalism. The question is, what will that look like? And will we be able to figure that out? Or will the people who are in power now with all the nuclear weapons and all of these things be the ones transitioning us to some other mode of production? So there's my sociological insights there.
I just want to thank Sally for having us. I think it's been a great conversation. I'm encouraged by what the Hiroshima mayor has just said about nuclear deterrence, because I know my husband wrote a book on nuclear deterrence that was translated into Japanese and handed to people. And it's exactly what Rob's been saying, a man who flew nukes around and then wrote about how will you ever prove whether nuclear deterrence has actually worked. So, you know, there's a lot of hope. I see a lot of positives happening in the future. And it's important that those of us with our grey hair and lines that we've earned on our faces are sharing some of those experiences and our and give hope to this future generations that the young ones will be able to carry it on. And our Disarmament and Security Centre website has a lot of educational material on it, and it's run by young people. Thank you, Sally.
Thank you, Kate. Tēnā koutou, thank you so much. This has been somewhat depressing, but also I think there are nuggets of inspiration and hope in there as well. And yeah, I think the big takeaway for me has been, yeah, I feel like we are silenced at that higher level, but we all still have a voice, so we need to be trying to use that as much as possible. Thank you all so much for sharing your wealth, your very, very vast amount of experience today. It's been really, really enriching.
Thank you, Sally. Thank you for having us. Really enjoyed being part of this conversation. It's a really important conversation to have.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much, Sally. And thank you, all the other panel members. It's really been very interesting. And thank you.